kids, Bat Segundo here, and I'm filled with a gushing optimism about this week's guest. Ron Jeremy is older than I am, he weighs more than I do, and his mustache, which reminds me of a small-town deputy who once had the temerity to arrest me for intoxication, frightens the hell out of me. But Ron Jeremy is apparently getting laid. I imagine a universe in which there are 600 Bat Segundos on the radio, each of them servicing a major FM radio station. Even the number of women that each of these 600 Segundos had their way with couldn't possibly equal the number of women that Ron Jeremy, one singular man, has banged. I don't know if this is because of the size of his penis, or if it is because Ron Jeremy is slipping something into cocktails. I tried this latter approach once myself with disastrous results. Either way, I must salute our young roving correspondent's efforts. This is the only interview I've introduced that can be described as praiseworthy.
So I'm here with Ron Jeremy, author of The Hardest Working Man in Show Business, which is his memoir of his time as a porn star. Ron, how are you doing?
Good. The working is in parentheses because that's the joke, the hardest man in showbiz.
Yes.
We're trying to be funny over at HarperCollins.
You growled at me at least once before we actually put the mics up.
So. I did?
Yes, you did.
I growled?
I may have hallucinated the growl. It's very possible.
I growled? Why would I growl?
I'm just trying to sort of, help your rep here, you know. So
oh, I
for
see.
People who might think it's a different form of hard, you know what I'm saying?
Oh, I gotcha. Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Oh, that kind of. Oh, I gotcha. Okay.
Gotcha.
Oh, I'm slow on the uptake. Oh boy.
I was going to ask you.
I'm the joke teller. Sorry about that.
Well, no problem. I was actually going to ask you who did you pay to get this book covered in yesterday's New York Times book review? I was shocked to see in the most intellectual, distinguished weekly publication. There right there was a...
That's a nice honor.
Yeah.
Nice honor. The New York Times took it. Out of thousands of books every year, they only take a few hundred, and mine is one of them.
Yeah.
I always like to say, I don't think they took Jenna Jameson's book. She had a bestseller.
Yeah.
I saw Jenna at the Hefner Mansion at the big party at Mardi Gras. Mm-hmm. She's with her boyfriend, who's like ultimate championship fighter, second ranked in the world. And then I said to her, you know, we both have the same publisher as HarperCollins.
Yeah.
Although she had Judith Reagan, who's not there anymore. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm with HarperCollins. So I said to her, I only made one request with a publishing company. She goes, what's that? That my book outsells yours. And she started laughing. Mm-hmm. Maybe it will, Ron, she said. Yeah, right, whatever.
Well, do you think...
She had a bestseller, but I got to New York Times. I got to an airport. Mm-hmm. Airports don't touch these books, but they did take mine. Chicago O'Hare.
Huh.
Selling it very well. They want me to autograph them when I get there.
Wow. What do you think accounts for you perhaps being taken a little bit more seriously than, say, Jenna Jameson?
I'm not sure if I was,
yeah.
But the thing is, I have twice as much years on the planet.
Yeah.
I have so much more history. Mm-hmm. You know, her story, you know, she needed Neil Strauss, who's a great writer, to take her story, which is interesting, and she's got a lot of good things to say, and to really embellish upon it. I have, how many years have I have? Over half a century of history, starting from parents who were both in the war, a mother who was a spy, who was in the OSS, which became the CIA, having uncles involved as gangsters who were involved with Bugsy Siegel, one of them. He was also involved with Costello. My dad tells stories about when, you know, he was a little boy going out to the Catskills because these big black limousines wanted to have kids in the car to look more innocent. On to my uncle, a cousin who died a war hero in the Battle of the Bulge. Onto being a former teacher, school teacher, master's degree, special ed, two BAs, education, theater, working with retarded children, working up at the Catskills, you know, being a waiter with lots of stories about that, being in the old famous Borscht Belt, watching the comics, doing comedy myself, going on to doing college lectures, including Oxford University and Trinity College in Dublin, and then doing a hit rap single, which was actually on Billboard half a year, doing MTV videos, porn naturally, there's a lot of porn in the book, stories with celebrities. Look at the pictures of my book versus other people's books.
Yeah.
There's pictures of everyone from Brad Pitt to Johnny Depp to Jim Carrey, Robin Williams. And with every picture is a story. Who has that? What other porn book has that?
Well, that's
I mean,
true.
Gene Roth said it was the most interesting porn book ever written.
But
who else comes? That's
also,
why I have. That's why I can be taken more seriously because there's other things in my book that have nothing to do with porn.
But you also had Eric Spitznagel on board with this. I'm wondering what role did he play?
He's the ghostwriter.
Yeah.
But I did have to go through a lot of what he said, and he'll admit it. Mm-hmm. He did. I think maybe he was rushed by HarperCollins. I don't know what the story was. Mm-hmm. The editor that we worked with back then is no longer with HarperCollins. Mm-hmm. He was maybe he was rushed because some of the facts he didn't refer to his tape. And he's a great writer, and he did a great job with the book, as you can notice.
Was he hired he's a nice because guy. Of his screenwriting book? He had the Confessions of a Porn Screenwriter last
probably
year.
Probably was written. Probably was. Yeah. Was that ever made into a movie?
I don't know if it was made into a movie, but it was certainly made into a book last year.
It was successful, right?
It was a
big writer for Playboy.
Yes. And Spy and Esquire, too.
Right. And I don't think they didn't really need a Neil Strauss for my book. He did Jenna Jameson's, Marilyn Manson's. Yeah. So I think I really have an interesting story. Yeah. And there's even a lot more that will be in the paperback that we didn't even finish.
Oh, really?
There were even more exciting stories. Oh. You know, meeting the president after he was no longer the president, mm-hmm. and being asked to do a photograph. Remember that's a funny story? Mm-hmm. I was the one to introduce Jessica Hahn to Tammy Faye.
Yeah.
Nowhere but in my book will you see that phone conversation. Both are crying, talking about Jesus, because they wanted to have a meeting on Rita Cosby, mm-hmm. but then MSNBC, but then just Tammy got taken ill, so they never had a meeting. Mm-hmm. So my book is the only time you're going to hear what Tammy Faye and Jessica said to each other after that huge scandal years earlier.
Yeah.
You know, so that's interesting. That's way beyond just porn. Mm-hmm. That's why, to answer your question, that's why I think it can be taken seriously, because there's things in there that do not relate to porn. Like, I wouldn't tell HarperCollins to call up Bill O'Reilly, say, we got a book from a porn star, I want to air him on the show.
Yeah.
You guys, they mentioned the political stuff in there, you know, parents who were in the war, a war hero, you know, my involvement in other areas besides porn with celebrities.
Do you think it's because you took upon this tone of, hey, I'm just a regular Jewish guy growing up in Queens, and I have a work ethic, and I'm a hard worker, and essentially I have this greater sort of aspiration. I mean, this is something I suppose that people can relate to.
I'd say yes, that they can relate to that. And I think that's what makes an interesting book.
Yeah.
You know, that's why I did it. And my dad also convinced me also, because I was always waiting and waiting and waiting. My dad says, look, I'm not getting any younger. My dad's like almost at 90. Mm-hmm. And he said, why don't you, do the book so I get a chance to see it and read it and maybe help participate with it. And some things are in the book that my dad contributed. Yeah. There's a nice picture of him in the Philippine Islands when they were, fighting the Japanese. Mm-hmm. And the picture of my mother in a trench coat when she was a spy. So there's interesting pictures in the book that go along with my entire story. And I take pride in that. Because in so many books you read from a lot of authors, especially autobiographies, they have great pictures that have nothing to do with the story. My stories are actually backed by the photographs that you see.
How much of this book is contingent upon the photos as opposed to the text? I mean, what would you say?
I like to say both. Yeah. I mean, first of all, the book is a year late because mm-hmm. Eric Spitznagel got a few facts wrong. Mm-hmm. And I discovered it, went through it like a fine-tooth comb, then did a second correction mm-hmm. and even a third correction. So it took me, because I wanted to make sure it was letter perfect. Mm-hmm. If you see the very beginning of the book, I make a statement that a lot of stories here are wild and crazy, involving a lot of big celebrities, but it's all 100% true. That press agents will admit it's true. They'll admit it's true. They can't deny it. That's true. And nobody gets outed or ratted on, because mm-hmm. I always make sure to say, if it's a sexual story, that they were single at the time.
Yes.
So nobody can accuse my book of breaking up couples. It's a fun book to read and a scandalous book in some ways.
So is the book more of a sort of, is it a memoir or is it really sort of more of a kind of entertaining, slightly gossipy kind of thing? Would you say? What was it designed by? 100%.
You're exactly right on both. Mm-hmm. It is a memoir. It's an absolute autobiography, starting at my birth. My dad talks about a few jokes about my birth. To my mother, saying my son Ron dances to a different drummer.
Yeah.
Growing up in a household with a mother who had Parkinson's disease, which is now a relevant topic because of Janet Reno and Michael J. Fox. My mother had cryogenic surgery, which has been discontinued. She was an early guinea pig. It cost her life. Mm-hmm. And I told Janet Reno that. And she thanked my mom for being one of the experimenters to stop that process. You know, so there's a lot of things that are totally memoir-ish and yet interesting. And of course, it's also a bit of a tell-all and a fun little gossipy thing. So I'd like to say that the book has elements of both. You read it, correct?
Yes, I did.
Would you? And you can be honest, of course. If you hated it, say you hated it.
I actually, believe it or not, I actually kind of enjoyed it. So,
wouldn't you say that's both gossipy and memoir-ish?
It is. You actually put yourself and you declare things as they are.
Yeah.
But I'm wondering...
I stick a little advice to people, like, ask Dr. Jeremy. That's just some fun stuff in there as well.
Yes. There's helpful advice on anal sex as well as many other things.
And maintaining erections, exactly. Things like that, yeah.
Then, of course, there's the tug technique and all those matter of things. Of yes, exactly. Well, I wanted to actually ask you about the nature of this book in relation to how some people perceive you. Like Al Goldstein and many others have called you sort of a walking publicity sheet.
Is Al.
Yeah, yeah. Well, of course, that's a good comeback. But I wanted to specifically ask about this of you. I mean, I entered the hotel room and I noticed that you were actually making several phone calls to your momentous, really impressive, actually, might I add, large binder of contacts and the like. So how much of this... How much of you is basically a walking publicity sheet, and is this book to some degree
more before? Mm. I was a lot more before, and Al's right. I'd meet people and I'd inundate them with my latest article. It's funny how you go through a progression. Mm-hmm. When I first got into the porn business, and it's so true, and I see kids doing it today and it makes me laugh. Mm-hmm. They'll show off their Hustlers, their Swanks, their Beaver magazine, their, you know, oh, look at me in Penthouse. Oh, Playboy gave me a good review. You know, and I did that too. And yeah. I have girls now that my friend Sunny Lane is kind of doing what I used to do. Mm-hmm. She even calls me her mentor. And she's really popular now. And she walks around with all her press clippings, her booklets. They even hire PR people now. Mm-hmm. Can you imagine that? That was unheard of in my day. There are girls today who hire PR firms. And they, a lot of them.
Yeah.
And they don't really have that much connections. So the PR firms get them at the Hustler and Penthouse. And, you know, then I achieved a certain amount of status doing consulting Boogie Nights, consulting 9.5 weeks, getting involved in a lot of mainstream movies, working with Frankenheimer, shooting footage for him. So then I started looking at my reviews in Time, Life, and Newsweek. And then you accelerate. Now I don't look, now I'm not going to, I wouldn't show off at that point and go, oh, look at me in Hustler. Yeah. I rode to a higher plateau. But then I was bragging about being on CNN. They did stories of me a few times on CNN, not Playboy Channel.
Yeah.
So then you achieve that level.
New York Times.
Post. And there was things in there years ago. Mm-hmm. I had articles by Nick Ravo that were for the New York Times, which then he put it into Salon Magazine. Mm-hmm. So this was, I was interviewed by the New York Times before. And the Post, Page Six, many times. Even back with the John Bobbitt movie, the Page Six, they made big articles on Page Six about that, you know. I put John Bobbitt in a film and then Divine Brown in a movie.
Yeah.
We called it a Doc Hugh drama. You get it? So I was getting a lot of mainstream press back then, so then I no longer carried Hustlers and Penthouses. Stopped dead in my tracks. Now I'm going to carry a Time magazine. Look at this. It said here in Time magazine, I was in a Frankenheimer film, you know, or George Wallace. Or it said in Time magazine, millennium issue of Time, last page about NSYNC using my name to check into hotels. Mm-hmm. Great story. And it was in Time magazine, the millennium issue, 2000. So that I'd carry with me. And I'd inundate people like Al Goldstein. Look at my press clippings. Oh, not again. I'd rather kill myself than watch Ron Jeremy's press. So I was always bragging about, I'm in this magazine, that magazine. And then your third plateau, you don't do dick. Mm-hmm. It's over. Have I handed you one press clipping?
No, I mean, but you do
normally
actually.
I would.
Yes.
And I have one right there about Boondock Saints being the number one straight-to-video feature at Blockbuster.
But you do have this rather impressive binder here on the desk across the room. I know from Pornstar that at that point it was 12 years in the making, so now we're talking like 16, 17 years in
the
making.
Of course, of course.
This, to me, seems rather incredible. First of all, I have to ask you, have you ever heard of Outlook? I mean, it's a lot easier to actually handle your contacts this way.
I know, that's why I know. I have to find somebody who knows his computers to put that in a whole computer. I'm living in the dark ages. When I was a kid, if you could type, you were considered a practicing homosexual. So the fact is now everyone types. That's the thing now, you know. And it's funny because you have to be a typist to be a computer. For a guy with a master's degree, and knowing a lot about things from world history on, I am a novice at computers and cell phones. Mm-hmm. Let's go further. I'm a blithering idiot. You know, I don't even barely know how to email people. I can receive emails.
Yeah.
I'm just living in, I just never took the time to want to learn about the internet. I mean, I have a website and all that kind of stuff, but I'm not that good at that stuff. That's why I still operate with an old phone book rather than carry a nice small little computer with everything on it.
Yeah.
With one chip can replace that entire thing.
Well, then,
it's, I'm just living in the dark ages, that's all.
Having established that, though, what would the purpose of this particular binder be in terms of wanting to kind of connect with all these people or wanting to like have these
photos? It's broken off into sections of locations. Like I have a San Francisco list. So I took that book because I'm calling friends from San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
But I still have to have the book with me because I still have people from New York calling me on the phone.
Yeah.
I got to call them back.
Yeah.
People say, Ron, hi, it's me. You got my number. Well, I got to look it up then.
This is as obsessive as a hardcore email zealot who has
it's chronological. It's not alphabetical.
Oh.
So I know when I first met them. So I go back. Like the clean white pages are the recent connections.
Sure.
The ones that are way back in the older pages are the old ones. And notice I got plastic on each page. I'm preserving it.
Is this thing an extension of the black book that you write about in this book in which the cop is about to confiscate it and you are sort of
that
pleading
is
with
the
this
one
is
they were
the gonna, same
that is they were
the
confiscate.
Same black
That's
book.
The exact book that was confiscated.
Wow.
And I Xeroxed it into other things. The cops let me Xerox a few of the pages.
Uh-huh.
But that is the exact same book.
Wow.
The only thing different between that one and the ones I talk about is I put some plastic around the pages now to preserve them.
Yeah.
So now that's protected, each page has a plastic around it.
I'm wondering, though, because it seems to me that this book is almost sort of a lifeline to some degree in the sense that you're making
it
calls
is.
At every spare moment.
I try not to, but without that book, I'd be screwed. I have some numbers on my cell phone, but I'd be screwed.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't. There are a lot of people I'd never talk to the rest of my life unless they know to call me. That number has, there's a whole list of Europe, Asia. You know, like if I didn't have that book, if that book got lost, that's why I've Xeroxed some of the pages. I'd probably go kill myself because people I can never talk to ever again.
Have you ever spent a day away from this book at all? Or
of course, weeks away from the book.
Yeah.
I'll leave it at home when I go out.
Okay.
I don't need it with me when I go out, because if I have to make a phone call, I'll just look at my cell phone or whatever. That's different.
Well, I guess what my question that you're very skillfully evading is, what is the purpose of this book in terms of wanting to connect with all these celebrities?
Oh, because it's the same thing as a phone book is to you.
Yeah.
Your cell phone has lists of people's names and numbers in there.
Sure.
That's all. It's just a phone book. That's all it is. Once in a while, I would use it for, like, in the back pages. I thought a really funny idea for a comedy act. I'm doing comedy on the road all the time still. And they even used me in The Aristocrats, mm-hmm. that comedy movie. I'm in one of the special scenes. So, and that's a movie with Robin Williams and the top name is George Carlin. It was an honor when Penn Jillette asked me to be in that movie. So people, I'm still doing some comedy. So that book comes, it says two purposes. One, I got a sudden idea for a joke. I'll write it down in that book, mm-hmm. in the back. And plus, it's my phone book to everybody. It's my numbers. If I want to speak to a girl here in San Francisco, mm-hmm. without that phone book, I can't call her up. I tell her I'm in town.
Yeah.
Like, you just saw me on the phone calling a girl who called me last week or so, wants to see me. Her number's in that book. Mm-hmm. And it would be on my cell phone if she called me today. But by now, her number's long gone from my cell phone. I don't program numbers into my cell phone.
Yeah.
I have a few, but I'd go nuts because every time I change cell phones, I'd kill myself. That book is permanent, and I have numbers in there that are very, very important, and some not that important.
Yeah.
So to answer your question, why do I carry that book? It's because it's my phone numbers.
I guess, though, I mean, I'm wondering...
Without that book, I couldn't call anybody in San Francisco.
I'm wondering, though, isn't there sort of a finite amount of people that any human being can sort of deal with? I mean, if there's thousands of names, there's got to be thousands of names
there
in that book.
But then I can meet a girl today who maybe, I just went to a club earlier today. We said hi to some old friends. Let's say a girl meets me in the lobby during a happy hour. It's 5 to 6.
Yeah.
And she wants to hang out. She gets very seductive.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe she does what Paris Hilton did in that famous story. She wants to see it.
Yeah.
I go, I do with Tracy Bingham in The Surreal Life. It's a known joke with me. When a girl wants to see it, you show the top, I show the bottom.
Yeah.
And then let's say that happens. And then the next thing we wind up messing around, let's say we do or don't, let's say we have sex.
Mm-hmm.
She comes up to my room, we mess around a little bit. Then she wants to see me again, I want to see her again, because I'm in San Francisco. She'll then be a part of that book.
Mm-hmm.
She'll give me her phone number, either on a card, and I'll transpose it into the book, or I'll put her number directly into my book under the San Francisco section.
Yeah.
See? Maybe she'll say, I'm going to be in L.A. tomorrow. Well, then she'll also be on my calendar, which is also a mess. Look at that thing.
Yeah.
And there'll be a little note saying, so-and-so is going to be in L.A. tomorrow.
Yeah.
Hey, I'll be in L.A. also. Maybe I'll take her out for lunch. So see, then she'll be both in my book and my calendar. It's like anybody else. It's just a phone book.
Are you intimidated by this book at all? Or I mean,
no.
It's just, it's really sort of an expansive document that you've been creating.
It's here. The same thing as everybody else's phone book,
mm-hmm.
just 100 times bigger and crazier looking and a lot messier because my handwriting's terrible in that.
Okay.
In fact, it's amazing that when the cops busted me, the vice cops could read it. Like Detective Como, who's mentioned in my book, would say to me, you know, Ron, why'd you have what's-his-name's name written twice? Wow, I can't believe he knew that. Well, one time was when she called me on the phone, so I put my messages. On the left side of each page is the messages I get off my phone. The right side are the permanent numbers. Sometimes you'd see the name twice, you know, because I haven't got the time to look up each number, so I'll just put it down, you know. And he was right. There are some numbers listed twice. I said, wow, he knows this. But the thing is, it's that exact same thing as your phone book.
Yeah.
What you did before cell phones were invented, you had a phone book, which you'd have to carry around sometimes, because if you had to call somebody on the road, you couldn't run to your house and get the number. That's exactly what that book is. It's just a big phone book.
Hmm.
Nothing more, nothing less.
Well, I want to actually ask you one sort of major question that we can kind of riff off of. Do you consider what you do, whether it be porn or whether it be sort of, you know...
Mainstream.
Or whether it be anything. Do you consider yourself an artist? Do you consider what you do to be art?
We made a joke about that. We say performer. As a part whore, part performer. I'm a performer.
Which you could also apply to mainstream Hollywood, too.
It's a very good point.
Yeah, exactly.
I wouldn't say we're doing Shakespearean soliloquies, but we're acting. If anyone, we said in a court of law, when they won the Hal Freeman case on pandering, trying to make it look like it's prostitution,
yeah.
We made a joke with the audience. And listen, if some woman thinks it's that easy to, let's say, have a death in the family or have bad news that day in the morning, but the afternoon you have to moan and groan like you're having a real good time,
mm-hmm.
you've got to be convincingly having a good time sexually when maybe you're not really into it. Let somebody here on the jury stand up and moan and groan like it's for real.
Yeah.
And they all said, and he's got a point there. It is definitely a performance. And sometimes it's actually acting. If you look at some of the earlier films, when we took on roles, played characters, went all over the world making films. Look at films of today, like Pirates,
yeah.
which has a real storyline in it, real dialogue, real acting. I'd say you're definitely acting in it.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, I've done a lot of mainstream, which involved real acting, like Boondock Saints, Orgasmo. You know, I've done a lot of regular films. I played Citizen Taxi, some of the trauma films. I've done A films, B films, and porn films, and a lot of TV. I acted in Nash Bridges, the Don Johnson TV show, and other TV shows besides. Done skits with Conan O'Brien. You have to be good. If you look like an ass, if you do a skit, you're not funny. I did a Benjamin Franklin skit with him. I did a Ron Jeremy Luggage skit with Conan, and I had to come across as being funny. Yeah. So, yeah, it all involves artist, I'd say so. It involves some amount of creativity as an actor. To play certain roles, I've had to be really creative and use my Stanislavski training.
Yeah.
And I was even accepted into Lee Strasberg. You know, I taught theater in New York. I belong to Equity. So I've done stage. So I'd say I'm an actor.
But simultaneously, there's the incident that you describe in the book in terms of appearing in Ronin, where you actually were in the chase sequence initially, and Frankenheimer, unfortunately, had to cut...
And he didn't want to. Mancuso ordered him to.
Yeah. He had to... Well, anyway, Mancuso, Frankenheimer, they had to cut your bit in order to
distract it, too recognizable.
Yeah, exactly.
And that happens, I guess, and I said to him, well, suppose Stallone and Schwarzenegger were in that part, because they're recognizable. And Frankenheimer said, I would have had to cut them, too. Because it slowed down, it made the audience stop and look at you when I went up to concentrate on the action. John would have kept me in, because he always made me look a little different. Yeah. Like John would make me shave the mustache. He'd use the name Ron Hyatt, wouldn't use the name Jeremy. So I'm on the international database. You'll see my name in Ronin. I'm on the credits of Reindeer Games. The films I've been cut from, I'm still in the credits, which is good, because then you know I wasn't an extra.
Yeah.
That I really had an acting scene in it. Because anybody could say I was in a film if they're extras.
Yeah.
I had a part. And I always stress that. People go, oh, you're just an extra. If I was an extra, I wouldn't be in the credits. You know, so the thing is, so it's depressing, but it's any you have that thing called the wink at the camera problem, that if you're recognizable, whether it be porn or even not from porn, you know, it's they sometimes don't want that. So I'll say, well, I'm an actor. I'll shave the mustache, dye my hair blonde, you know, and that's what actors do. We'll change our looks.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's often been a problem being the recognizability. And of course, there's the porn. You get a studio executive who's got a problem with it. Well, he's a born-again Christian or a Mormon or his wife's religious and they don't want Ron Jeremy being in the movie. I've had some controversy with that.
Yeah.
Adam Rifkin had a fight to keep me in the chase. Mm-hmm. There's only two dialogue scenes, two dialogue pieces, a little cameo.
Yeah.
And yet the executives had a problem with it. I was a cameraman, but Adam kept me in and he fought them.
Mm-hmm.
In Studio 54, I had two lines in the movie. The heads at Miramax, Weinstein was okay with it. Because I kind of played myself, in a way, at Studio 54, having a quarrel at the coat check room.
Yeah.
Did not distract from anything.
Yeah.
You know, so depends on the type of film, if it's distracting, you know, if it's a major studio versus a quirky little comedy. See, it depends on... So it depends where it fits.
I'm wondering if it's a matter of the fact that you're getting these character roles, essentially, for these mainstream...
I'm not a romantic lead.
Yeah.
My younger days, if you look at my earlier pictures in the book,
yeah.
I was kind of nice looking. I was kind of spiffy, had muscles and a flat stomach.
Yeah.
You know, but then as I got older and got a little chunkier, you're not going to see me play a romantic lead now in any medium. And now I am a character actor. That's what I'll play in any kind of medium. As would John Belushi or Jim Belushi or any chunky comic, you know, or even a Jack Black, maybe. You know?
I'm wondering if you've contemplated sort of starting an independent film project where you're in some sort of role that is perhaps more serious and that is different from this perception of you as Ron Jeremy, the wacky guy who
I'd love someone to take a chance on me for that. Now, Troy Duffy did.
Mm-hmm.
The film Boondock Saints is not comedic, although I'm telling the guy to tell a joke, funny man. Remember that movie?
Yeah.
It's huge. It's a big, big film in colleges. In fact, it did so well, after 5 years of being released, a major studio picked it up, 20th Century Fox.
And it became a cult item, too.
It is, and it was on Roper and Ebert. Got good reviews from them. And I have a very serious part in that. I play a gangster who's going to kill somebody, and then I get killed myself.
Yeah.
That's not a lot of dialogue, but I was serious.
Yeah.
I played a serious cop in a film called American Virgin
mm-hmm.
with Robert Loggia and Bob Hoskins. And I have an article from Variety that says Ron was out of character. Adam put me in a film called Night of the Golden Eagle with James Caan, where I played the owner of a bookstore, a serious biker, long gray hair. They gave me and tattoos on my face. And I was a serious character.
Yeah.
So I have played those roles, small parts.
But I guess it's a matter
comedy
of having,
like Orgasmo.
I guess it's a matter of having something similar to, like, you know, Travolta in Pulp Fiction or Robin Williams in The World
According to Garp. Someone's got to take a chance on me.
Yeah.
And again, with a porn background, it's very hard that a major studio or even a big independent company would take a chance on a broad actor with a role that big sometimes.
Because
again, porn has helped me and hurt me. It works both ways.
How would you describe in terms of like the double-edged sword here? Yeah,
it's hurt me from anything like we just discussed, how it hurts. In a major film, they figure I'll distract. And that, you know, Disney, a Touchstone, Buena Vista, Hollywood Pictures, that have films made for kids, a TV series that, you know, a network that would have a recurring role, doubt they'd take a chance on a porn star. But Fox might. Cable shows would. The Surreal Life did. I mean, all reality shows will take a chance. And, you know, we could have a small recurring role or an appearance on a major show. And that's not necessarily advertise a commercial product like toothpaste, but maybe Yes for Rubbers.
Yeah.
So and we're limited. But it helps in the fact that young directors think it's fun to have someone like me or Jenna Jameson in a movie. The Roger Averys, the Troy Duffys, the Trey Parkers, Adam Rifkins. They get a kick out of using me. You know, even in the old school like Frankenheimer, they'll get a kick out of it because they're friends of mine. They think I'm a good actor. And I'll say, look, I think it's cool to have Ron Jeremy in a movie as long as it's not distracting. Like a Something About Mary kind of movie.
Yeah.
You know, like Orgasmo. Adam Rifkin did a film called Homo Erectus, a caveman comedy with Dave Carradine. I played a hairy caveman. Perfect casting. Audiences who see that it's me, it's not going to detract. So see, if it's a quirky comedy versus a serious chase scene or a serious drama,
yeah,
you know, it depends where we're best suited. I'd rather play all roles,
yeah,
but sometimes they won't take a chance on me unless they're a good friend.
I guess I'm wondering, though, you describing this as it would be a kick to have Ron Jeremy. Or it would be a quirk to have Ron Jeremy.
A lot of directors say that.
As opposed, I mean, you know, you even described the moment in this book, you know, you had a friendship with Sam Kinison,
yeah,
the great former comic.
He was going to put me in his film I took.
Yeah.
And then it got canceled.
But you described...
He put me in his music video. He put me in his HBO special.
That's very true. But yeah, you described this moment where the two of you are sitting there watching one of your films. And Sam Kinison is sitting there laughing his ass off because he sees there's a clock radio there.
I did. I mean, I went now, such detail.
Yeah.
No wires, no cars in the background.
Yeah.
And I'm shot in a desert. And, you know, and he says, Ron, look at the freeze frame. Look, wait, what's that? Oh, fuck. You can see what time it is. You see the cord in the guy's pocket. It's a clock radio, you asshole.
But what I'm suggesting is if even
have thought of that at the time, you know.
If even your closest friends are looking at you as sort of, oh, it's a kick to have Ron, as opposed to what Frankenheimer said, Ron is a good actor. It doesn't matter whether he's done porn or not. I mean, this has got to sort of bother you that you're considered more of a sort of quirk or a kind of pedantic sort of, you know, eccentricity that an element that we can throw into a film.
He was like pedantic, we can't talk, because I didn't get pedantic out of Hustler Erotic Video Guide. I never saw that word there.
Okay.
He was like pedantic, again, to confuse our audience. I'm kidding. Go ahead.
I mean, the point is you're something of an eccentricity.
Yes.
When viewed in this particular element.
Yes.
Now, this kind of goes away for what you told me earlier in the sense that you consider what you do to be artistic.
Say that. A lot of what I've done is not artistic.
Okay.
When I go to a set, go, honey, here's a cup of coffee. Eat me. That's not artistic. When I make this noise, diamonds are a girl's best friend, but it comes a pearl necklace you're never going to forget. That's not that artistic. Although when I do have a climax where I start discussing Nietzsche and saying, oh, my little sperm about to proclaim I am here, I'm now, I'm going to climax. You know, my little sperm proudly proclaiming, you know, that that we're existential, we deserve to be here. Get out of the way. Here we come, right on your chin. That's kind of creative. I wrote those lines.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it depends. Sometimes it's artistic. Sometimes it's autistic.
Yeah. Well, then.
That's my joke. I used to teach autistic kids.
Sure.
Sometimes
sure.
it's smart. Sometimes it's not. I wouldn't say all my performances are artistic. Some of them are just, sometimes they're creative, that makes it artistic. Sometimes it's just a job, which means you're professional. Mm-hmm. It means it's a skill, not a creative position.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes you do something that's skillful. Sometimes it hits the word creative. Then it becomes artistic.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd say it's two themes running in the performers in porn. You need a certain amount of skill, for sure.
Yeah.
Creativity, not necessarily. You know, but there are some acting parts I've seen in mainstream Hollywood
mm-hmm.
that were more skill than creativity. Well, they just went through the motions and weren't really acting that good, you know. So I'd say porn is a microcosm of Hollywood,
yeah,
and that you see some of the same elements.
But does
so
it,
I would say
does it bother you?
Not
this
all
decision?
My jobs are artistic.
Yeah,
it would have bothered me more if I got into the business today, because back when I got into the business in the 70s, it was all film.
Yeah,
almost every movie had a script, a thick one, and they were really made well. I felt like an actor for 9 days. 9 days dialogue, 1 day sex.
Mm-hmm.
Bad Girls, Ecstasy Girls, Coed, I wasn't in that, but the ones that were that time period, Talk Dirty to Me, Nothing to Hide, Coed Fever, Cafe Flesh, Amanda by Night, Fascination, Sizzle, Roommates, In Love.
Yeah.
Roommates, which I was in, and Cafe Flesh, which I wasn't in, played in regular theaters,
yeah,
alongside Raiders of the Lost Ark. You know, they were treated as regular movies that just happened to have sex in it.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes they cut it out, sometimes they didn't cut it out. Deep Throat 2, Bad Girls 2. We wrecked an entire storefront on Bad Girls 2.
Yeah.
We shot it where they shoot Dukes of Hazzard. We had cars smash into stores, go over cliffs. Who sees that in porn today?
Yeah.
You know, except for Pirates and some of the exceptions. Or I work with Metro, is the company I work with, and Metro Interactive does some high budget movies. But again, you felt like an actor. You worked, you know, 9 days dialogue, one day sex. Now most of the time you work on a porn film, you're doing sex. So it's changed, you know. But I mean, I would certainly say that it was you felt like an actor. It was a performance back then.
Back then, but right now, do you feel that
you're once in a while it still is, but majority no. If the business was the way it is today, I probably couldn't justify it or rationalize it in my mind to myself or my family. Mm-hmm. So I probably would not have gotten into the business today. I'd still be teaching. Because the majority of what's out there today is called gonzos, pro amateurs, amateurs, where it's a girl walking into a hotel room saying, hi. Yeah. Hi, honey, where are you from? What are your hobbies? Are you a dancer? Why don't you dance for me? That's nice. Blow me. That's it for your dialogue. Yeah. I wouldn't have felt creative enough to do that. Because remember, back then, if you look at my earliest films, there's a lot of good acting in them, and I'll stand behind it. Fascination, it's a terrific film. They use a lot of that in my documentary. I play a nerd named Ernie Gordon, moves out of his home, gets into fights with my mother. I buy a book called How to Seduce Women. I follow the guidelines of the book, but I'm still a nerd. I do things all wrong. So the moral at the end is I wind up being myself, and I get my neighbor. So it's like, just forget the book. Just be yourself, and you'll get the girl. So I even had a little bit of a message. Well-made film by Chuck Vincent, who then went on to do mainstream films. He put me into a film with Chris Lemon, Jack Lemon's son, called COD, and that got me into the Screen Actors Guild. But Chuck was a very talented filmmaker. Yeah. And so, man, remember, Abel Ferrar, Wes Craven had
David
done
Cronenberg also.
Rumor has it too. He directed Marilyn Chambers in Rabid.
Yeah.
So a lot of big directors had done porn. So I got a chance to work with some of these guys in the early part of their lives, and they were talented. Yeah. So you can't say that all porn is not artistic. Some of it is.
Yeah. But do you think the current...
A lot of it is. And back in the early days, most of it was. You had to be a real filmmaker. Yeah. This wasn't shooting on videos. You had to have an Aeroflex BL3 camera. You had to have a Panavision. Usually Gary Graver, who shot for Orson Welles and also shot for us. David Wirth, who shot for Clint Eastwood and also shot with us. The guy who shot Children of the Corn shot Deep Throat. Mm-hmm. So come on, you're dealing with real filmmakers back in those days.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, Joao Fernandez was his name.
Yeah.
So again, I don't know if they're going to want me outing them like this, but it's on the internet, it's okay.
Yeah.
So keep that in mind, that there are real filmmakers that were doing film porn back then. So of course it was a real artistic medium for that situation.
If the majority of what you do you would consider not really particularly artistic or not really...
Today.
I'm wondering if what propels you to keep moving forward today...
The beautiful girls and I'm having a good time.
Mm-hmm.
Now it's more compelled by making money, mm-hmm. having sex with beautiful women,
mm-hmm.
and still trying to create a fun little character, even though the script doesn't even call for it.
Mm-hmm.
I'll add it. You know, I'll try to see what's going on and make it fun. Even if it's a pro-amateur or even a gonzo,
yeah.
I'll try to put my Ron Jeremy personality into it. I'm not taking on a character, but then the comedy instincts will take over. I'll try to be funny and creative, let you enjoy the scene, then shut the hell up when the sex starts. Because
yeah.
as directors have told me, let the comedy stop when the sex begins. Because guys can keep an erection and laugh at the same time.
I wanted to actually ask you about your workaholism. Specifically, you note in the book something quite interesting, and that is you can go ahead and be at a shoot in L.A. and then take a red eye to New York just to do a shoot the next day.
That's changed a bit.
Okay.
Now, remember, when the documentary was done, I was a little more desperate.
Yeah.
Trying more hard to get mainstream work.
Mm-hmm.
My sister called me an extra in movies. That's before Boondock hit the theaters and you know, or the video, and before 54 and Rodney Dangerfield's movies. So I thought I was suddenly having much bigger speaking parts now.
Yeah.
So and now the reality shows came along. I've had the lead on a reality show, 3 of them, 2 in America and 1 in England.
Mm-hmm.
And I've lectured in colleges. So things have changed a bit. I wouldn't fly across the country for a day's work anymore.
Yeah.
But I did back then, you know, and that got me to be seen in so many movies and experience different kinds of directors, different cast, the beautiful girls of California,
mm-hmm.
the more intense girls of New York. It was kind of fun doing that, you know, and I was a workaholic and probably still am in a different way, you know. Just my nature. I guess I never did drugs, barely drink, don't smoke, got a master's, so I've always had a work ethic. So, I mean, if the job comes along, I often take it. Then I get mad at myself for taking it when it comes close to the event. Why didn't I turn this one down? So now I turn down more.
Mm.
If you look at my calendar in the first few months, you'll see it's jam-packed. Look at it around March and April. It starts to ease up.
Yeah.
I'm finally learning to stop taking work. It was a fear that you figure the phone will stop ringing.
Yeah.
So you take most jobs that come along. But now let it stop ringing. It'll be okay.
But in your case, there is the inevitable aspect of virility declining. Yes. That in the next probably. It's,
I feel I'm a little slower than I was before. Yeah. I still get a boner without the help of any drug. Mm-hmm. And I'm chasing age. You know, a lot of people my age are taking Viagra up the yin-yang. There are guys half my age taking Viagra. And Vigorex and Extends, products that I endorse, by the way, Vigorex and Extends. I do those infomercials at night.
Yes.
Never took them, but I've seen them work right in front of my eyes with my actors when I'm directing. So I'm chasing Father Time. We'll see what happens. So far, the penis still works, and I'm grateful.
Yeah.
My dad still works, and he's 89.
Well, you also note that you don't smoke, you don't drink, you don't do drugs and all that. But at the same time, I've seen pictures of you in the beginning of the book, which is at the start of your porn career. As you, by your own admission, you have a flat stomach. And what we have seen is what we have seen is this
food.
Sort of food, yes.
I went from the gym to the buffet.
Yes.
And that's almost harder to get rid of that problem than drugs. Yeah. You go to an AA program, you can't even have a glass of wine at dinner. So even a mild amount of alcohol, 10 years later, they tell you not to do.
Yeah.
Overeating might be the hardest thing to cure because you still have to eat. You can't just be like alcohol or drugs and just not touch it anymore.
Yeah.
You still got to eat. So it's so hard to avoid eating too much. And I eat healthy foods. I have good blood sugar. I'm very healthy. I can still run fast, jump, swim. I could do anything I could do when I was younger. I'm just too heavy because I'm eating good food but too much good food. Like, I'll skip desserts, but what's on your plate? Are you done with that?
Yeah.
I'll take that steak. Oh, you over there in the corner. You finished with your salad? I'll eat that.
But someone argued...
I just overeat good food.
Yeah, but someone argued that that would be just as much of a bad habit or an addiction as anything else.
Sure it is.
As any of these other sort of things.
Sure it is.
Why do you think that the porn industry has been a kind of influence towards this?
I think I had a bit of an overeating habit even before then. Mm. When I was a waiter in the Catskills, I'd finish off a steak and go for another one. I'm gluttonous.
Yeah.
I love the flavor so much. I just want to keep on eating.
Yeah.
I hate that, like a back massage. Don't you hate when it's over? The worst thing about a back massage is when they leave. No, please. Just 2 more minutes in the back. The same thing with eating. I love the food. It tastes so good when it goes down my face. Mm-hmm. That, I'll just have another one, you know. And I don't really need the other one. I'm not that hungry, but I could certainly eat it.
Yeah.
I'm not full. I'm very hyperactive. I don't think I've ever been full after a meal. Mm-hmm. I can always eat again, but I have to use willpower not to.
Yeah.
And once in a while, the willpower goes away. Like it's like at a buffet, which are torturous.
I'm wondering if you get sort of really kind of antsy if you don't eat something. I mean, I certainly do. You know,
I feel good when I don't eat. I haven't eaten anything today all day.
Yeah.
And it feels great. When I look at my stomach, it looks a little flatter than usual. Yeah. But once you eat, it starts to stick out a little bit, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I feel good when I'm hungry. It's a great feeling because I know that I can satisfy it at any moment. Mm-hmm. If I was in Biafra right now or Africa or India and I was feeling hungry, it'd be a little more scary.
Yeah.
I know that I can eat the minute I snap my fingers, I can have some food.
Yeah.
That's the great thing about America.
Your Kennison routine as well.
Oh, of course. Come to where the food is!
Yes, exactly.
The best line is the opening line. I'm watching this TV show, and I see these poor kids going, won't you please help?
Yeah.
These kids are starving. Maybe someone on the camera crew has a sandwich!
Exactly.
Don't feed them yet. Come on, Haji. Get back in the mud and throw the flies on your face. You gotta look like you're hungry. Kids probably in the Screen Actors Guild, you know? Mm-hmm. Kids going, zoom in, get a good angle, zoom in. You know?
Gotcha.
Funny routine.
Definitely. I want to actually ask you about a piece that appeared in The New Yorker by Susan Faludi about 95. She took you to task, actually, for this very top problem we're talking about, but she suggested that your singular purpose in life was to gross people out, and she quoted you as saying, I don't care what they say about me as long as they spell my name right. I'm wondering, do you...
That is a very famous Hollywood slogan. The fact that Susan couldn't understand that. You know what made me mad? On the documentary, I badmouthed that.
Yeah.
And you know what kills me? She still thinks that was a nice article and thinks that we're kind of friends. Mm-hmm. You know, does she listen to her? Does she listen to this?
She may. Who knows?
I don't know why she can't understand that was mean. Very, very... And she lied. I licked... But since people know I love to eat, if you exaggerate it, people will probably believe it.
Yeah.
Like, he licked the bottom of the cream cheese box.
Yeah.
She got me lox and cream cheese at some restaurant.
Yeah.
I didn't lick the box. Like, why would she say something so mean?
Yeah.
Yes, she could say he ate a lot. He finished it off. Of course, I'm doing an interview. You bought it. Mm-hmm. You know? I mean, so it was so mean. And that comment that you just said, you know, I live to gross people. Why would she say that? I didn't gain weight to gross people out. In fact, when I usually shoot, I try to suck in the gut, let the penis look real nice and big, and do a nice little sex scene.
Yeah.
You know, no, Ed Powers gained weight. We're not grossing people out. I have a big penis. People like seeing me have sex. I've actually become more popular with the average looks than when I was young and good looking because the average guy relates.
Yeah.
You know, it's like the guy, right? You know, that's like, there's hope. You always see the captain of the football team and the cheerleader. Now they see me with a cheerleader going, damn. Now there's hope for all of us.
Yeah.
I got more famous being the everyman than being young and thin and better looking from the days of Playgirl.
Sure.
And you see the book, I shot for Hustler and Playgirl. I had a lot of great photographs, and I was in Playgirl 4 times in really attractive poses. I mean, there's no arguing. People say I was very good-looking as a kid, but I got careless with the weight. Yeah. Wasn't the gross. You don't eat saying, I'm not going to eat food so I can gross people out and have sex. What a mean thing to say.
Yeah.
And the thing that really pissed me about Susan Faludi, that disgusting little bitch, is that she acted like my friend. She came into my home. She acted like she was a buddy. You know, and I brought her into my home. We went places together. She came to sets. You know, so she came across like she was a buddy almost.
Yeah.
That's why it hurt so much more. If she acted like she was doing, I don't mind people doing mean pieces. This could be a mean piece.
Yeah.
You could say Ron Jeremy was fat and disgusting, made me wait to talk to girls on the phone. Whatever you like, I don't care. I'm all jaded at this point. But the thing is, she came across like a friend. We spent days together. So it was a real slap in my face. And Susan Faludi is totally retarded.
Mm-hmm.
That she can't understand why that was a mean article. She told people, and I heard from good sources, that she didn't know why Ronda was upset.
Yeah.
Can you see why I was upset?
Yeah, I can.
Why can't she? Is she that stupid?
Well, maybe she is so...
And she praised Mike's... She praised the gay actor. Like he was God's gift to... Like she praised Jeff Stryker in that article.
Yeah.
Like what a wonderful father he is. How the hell does she know? First of all, I like the guy a lot. Jeff's a nice guy. How does she know that the minute she left the apartment, he didn't throw the kid in the closet along with his ticket toys and say, no, I'm coming out till next Thursday.
Yeah.
And he didn't beat the kid senseless. How does she know he's a good father? So she makes assumptions about people, and yet me, she slammed.
Yeah.
Jeff Stryker could do no wrong in that article.
Mm-hmm.
Anything he did was God. Me, I'm a slime bag. I mean, she was so mean. It just was unbelievable.
Do you think that this kind of takes away from, I guess, because we are talking about The New Yorker here, which is a very highbrow magazine,
mm-hmm.
that is perhaps setting sort of, you know, trends for the
I was in there since.
Yeah.
I've been in many magazines since then, though, just as big as they are.
But here's
nice
your...
things. People found me charming on The Surreal Life and
yeah.
said I come across like a nice guy. Almost every interviewer you read, look at The Post, look at The New York Times.
Yeah.
They all said, no matter what you say about the guy, he actually is a likable guy.
Yeah.
How come they say it? Yet Susan Faludi never added that little fact in there. She did mention that I was the number one actor in porn. She mentioned about the John Bobbitt movie. She gave me great press
mm-hmm.
for the John Bobbitt film. So she said things that were good. And I'm glad the article existed for that reason. She tried to make an article about the plight of the men,
mm-hmm.
Cal Jammer, who commits suicide. So she took the point of that isn't just the women who work hard, the men do too.
Mm-hmm.
So I appreciated the basic attitude of the article. So what she did was good. If I had my choice of the article appearing or not appearing, I'm glad it appeared.
Because
yeah. she did take on the plight of the men. No one ever bothered to do that up to that time. It was always the women, the women, the women. So I liked what she did in the article itself. Why she singled me out and was mean to me, I'll never understand. Why a comment like that, you know, live to gross people out, why would you say that?
Yeah.
What person gains weight to do that? So she'll tell every fat person in America, you're just gaining weight to gross people out, aren't you? You're a husband. You have a wife.
Mm-hmm.
You're gaining weight to make your wife sick and nauseous, aren't you? So when you fuck her, she'll throw up. No, that's not the case.
Yeah.
We don't think of that when we eat. And the same thing about... Like you just said, he thinks it's great that people talk about him. Yes!
Mm-hmm.
Because she couldn't understand why. She was talking about a specific reference when they embarrassed me in a Beavis and Butthead episode.
Yeah.
They say, he's kind of fat, isn't he? The band members use him just to get chicks. First of all, anyone knows that no rock star needs my help getting girls. They get more girls than I'll ever get.
Yeah.
And for free. Girls often do me because they're getting a paycheck, you know? So she actually couldn't understand why I enjoyed them bad-mouthing me on Beavis and Butthead. Saying, Susan, you idiot! There's not one porn star who's ever been on Beavis and Butthead except me, twice. Then they did a caricature of me and made an Ebenezer Screw. You know, they had my picture on it. Are you kidding me? I've done 12 videos for MTV since then. She didn't understand why, as long as they spell your name right. That's the oldest Hollywood proverb, whatever. Adage or whatever it is.
Yeah, yeah.
That's a very famous expression.
Mm-hmm.
As long as they talk about you. You know, it's a good thing, generally, unless it's a crime. If you go out and get arrested, that's different. But if they talk about you in Hollywood and major media like Beavis and Butthead
yeah.
or MTV, of course, if they slam you, it's still good. Drew Carey mentioned me. Look all the slams I got in my book
yeah.
from Drew Carey, Sarah Silverman. They're all mean jokes, but they're talking about me.
Yeah.
Those things make you cult because then the fans defend you.
Mm-hmm.
Say, how dare Drew Carey say that about our Ron Jeremy? You know, he made a very funny comment about, you know, being good looking, having a big penis.
Mm-hmm.
Should have one or the other, not both. Look at Ron Jeremy. That's fair. Because
yeah,
he was mad that Brad Pitt has a big one.
Yeah.
He said, it's cute.
Yeah.
It's a little insult, but it's funny. You know, so I mean, who cares? I love that stuff because it makes you more known. It's cult. It feeds itself. And it actually leads to more work and more comments from Jay Leno, which I've had plenty of. And that kind of, it's all good in the long run. That Hollywood expression is for real. And she couldn't understand it. Yeah. So for an intelligent woman, and she's intelligent, why would she not understand that famous expression that as long as they spell your name right, talking about you is a good thing? She said, I can't believe that Ron feels that way. Can't believe I feel, everyone in Hollywood feels that way. Is she that dumb? Is she that outside the Hollywood attitude? Is she so hung up on New York that she can't understand that really is a Hollywood expression? It really exists? And she couldn't understand why I follow that. Every actor in Hollywood follows that.
Yeah.
Why would you single me out for that? She really is a fucking idiot.
But at the same time, there's something of a paradox here. If you don't care what people are saying about you, this is a 10-year-old, 11-year-old.
Well, you care, yeah. But you enjoy it.
Yeah.
You still enjoy it to some extent. You know, you think back and you kind of laugh.
Yeah.
I like that Drew Carey said it. I wouldn't have put it in my book if he didn't.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, so why? So it's an expression that exists and everyone agrees that it's a good thing.
Yeah.
Unless you're involved in the law. If you get arrested for bad things, then it's different. No, that can hurt you. But other than the law mentioning you, being mentioned in an arrest, being mentioned in Hollywood is a good thing, whether they say good things or bad things, as long as they say things.
Mm-hmm. Well, wasn't a particularly good thing for Michael Richards recently, though. The infamous incident at the Comedy
Store. If you're caught misbehaving, no. But I'm going to tell you something funny. Often that'll work in your favor, too.
Mm-hmm.
When you're insulting an ethnic group like him and Mel, it didn't really hurt Mel Gibson.
Yeah.
His show still made money. He'll be making movies from now till next 10 years.
Yeah.
So in a way, I don't know if it helped him. But it didn't really hurt him. But in most cases, when they talk about you, it does help. You know, you can bring up specific instances where it does not, involving abuse with a wife, and getting involved in bad sexual situations, being with minors. No, that's bad. That'll never, ever look good. Certain arrests will always be bad. You know, but the majority of times, if they talk about you, it's good. Paris Hilton has proved that. Every major celebrity has proved that at one point or another. That they not only beat the odds, it actually helped them.
Mm-hmm.
Wouldn't you agree?
Well, to some degree. I mean, it depends. I mean,
the public... Each incident has to be specific.
The public often has a very short-term memory, which actually I would argue that, like, okay, you include this incident in this book of Jessica Hahn and Tammy Faye Baker making up. Well, this was like a decade ago. Who cares about this anymore? Do they even have the memory to remember
this? But it's still so fascinating because they always remember that Jessica Hahn kind of brought down that entire PTL.
Yeah.
And Tammy insulted her on nationwide TV.
Yeah.
And called her not even that attractive, and there was a big slam dunk, and they've never, ever met since.
Yeah.
Now imagine in my book, you actually see them talk to each other, where Jessica apologizes, they both start crying, Tammy forgives her, mm-hmm. Jessica says, I wish you were my mom. I mean, that's pretty heavy stuff. So it is 10 years late, but it's still very interesting, because we never had any closure on that. What if Tammy and Jim Baker actually ran into Jessica Hahn today? Well, she did, and it's in my book. So that is interesting.
Well, it's also...
But is it as interesting today as it was 2 years ago? No. Look, we did a film with Divine Brown a year and a half after the whole scandal. The film did not do as well as it could have. Had that film been made right after the scandal, with the Hugh Grant scandal, would have been knocked off the shelves. Would have been as good as the Paris Hilton or the Pam Anderson tape.
Yeah.
As it is, since she waited a year and a half to do straight work, do a TV show in England, do that commercial about Got Milk, do the commercial about No Excuses, whatever she did, then she thought she was doing mainstream acting.
Mm-hmm.
Then she realized she really wasn't, so a year and a half later she did the movie, Sunset and Divine, a Doc Hugh drama, a porn film which I directed, and I'm in.
Yeah.
With her, I do a sex scene with her.
Yeah.
And coincidentally, Paul Anderson was on the set to watch that movie, which was then part of his research for the future Boogie Nights.
Yes.
Another little inside connection there. Yeah. But the thing is, sometimes delaying time weakens the interest. So yes, 10 years later with Tammy Faye, it's not as exciting, but it's still newsworthy.
It's also a way to kickstart porn careers, as you point out in the book, with the whole John Wayne Bobbitt situation, how this became a sort of great seller because of this sort of B-list celebrity component to it. And
sure.
You also describe several near misses, such as LaToya Jackson and Heidi Fleiss. I actually wanted to ask you about this, tied in with the big picture of where porn is now, because now, as we've sort of discussed a little bit, there's this great sort of, you know, porno filter, amateur sites, gonzo videos and the like. Suddenly there's this huge glut of porn right now. So maybe, I'm not sure if you were 5-10 years perhaps ahead of your time. What do you think? Do you think that a sort of celebrity component is now going to be what it's going to take to get a particular porn film?
It certainly will help sell, because now the DVD market's having trouble, because VOD's taken over.
Yeah.
They've even closed Tower Records in Los Angeles.
They did.
Now it's going to be VOD, with your computer, your telephone, your internet. You'll be punching in what you want to see. So it's a whole new era in entertainment. And porn's always been at the forefront of the mediums that involve entertainment.
Yeah.
So we'll be involved some one way or another, but the business is having some problems right now, because the transition is going to cause some companies to fold or go under. So celebrities will certainly jumpstart a porn film. And by me using Divine and Bobbitt, and then later on Larry Flint used Snoop Dogg, not to do hardcore. But then some rap stars do hardcore, like DJ Yella, Funk Dubious. We might have Lil' Kim do a narration. I've had Ice-T and Vince Neil in my movies, Lemmy from Motorhead. We're using semi-celebrities to be in the films. It does help a lot. Because now you need something new, and there's now what they call niche marketing. Yeah. You know, the business is so saturated. It's such a saturated business today, where anything you could possibly dream of or want is going to be in a fantasy. You know, from old girls, young guys, twosomes, threesomes, foursomes, multiple partners, gang scenes, all kinds of orifices being penetrated twice, three times. You know, blacks on Asian, Asian and blacks on white, white on Asian. I mean, just, it's a totally foot-worshipping S&M, B&D, IOD, IOU. I like to make a joke about that. They're all, it's all out there. Whatever you're foot-worshipping, smothering tapes, putting your boobs in a guy's face.
Well, more than that, core, very hardcore, extreme sort of stuff.
And also the extreme things, the choking, spitting. Yeah. It's just a saturated, anything your fantasies are, we're going to create for you, as long as it's legal. Mm-hmm. You know? And we'll even stretch the boundaries in some cases with Max Hardcore and Extreme Video. I don't do a lot of those type movies, but they exist. And the thing is, it'll continue being like this till eventually it goes to the new media, and some of the periphery and the flotsam and jetsam are going to disappear.
Well, how do you figure into all this? I mean,
I'm an actor and I occasionally direct. And I'm not as involved in porn as I used to be. I have a bunch of major motion pictures coming out pretty soon. Yeah. Then hopefully I'll get more mainstream work. I have a good agent working with me. So, which, by the way, you can see him on my new website, which I could plug. I guess myspace.com/RonJeremy. Here's my calendar where I'm going to be. Has a couple of celebrity pictures, a skit with Steve-O from Jackass, and lists how to get a hold of me through Mike Esterman, one of my better agents. So I just see myself being part of the business until I eventually decide to quit and go home. When I find my penis under the pillow and I have to can't work anymore. And as long as the penis works, I still do porn once. I'm doing one this Thursday. I'll still do porn once in a while because it's too much fun to quit. I have a contract with Metro. They still find me valuable enough, do occasional scenes, and go on the road representing Metro in various video stores and bookstores around America. So I'm still valuable enough to be working. Then maybe there'll come a day when they don't want me anymore.
Well, also, since these particular porns are often tied into your appearances doing stand-up comedy, I mean, there's a certain kind of food chain here that sort of disrupts. I mean, how... Do you think things are just going to reconfigure, or how are you going to deal with this?
I'll keep riding the way while it exists. I still have a certain demand. My films still sell, whether, you know, in porn. People still get a kick out of seeing me with a beautiful girl. So I don't work that much, so I'm not going to be glutted or saturated. I mean, I think Ed Powers, who's similar to me, similar age, a character actor, he has a dirty debutante. He's up to number like 200-something. Mm-hmm. I do a series for Metro called On the Loose. I'm on series number 5 in 2 years. You know, so I'm trying to take it nice and slow. Yeah. Keep an occasional sex scene here and there. Get the old penis working in front of a camera. Mm-hmm. Until eventually I just can't do it anymore and I'll just continue on the mainstream and the public appearances and the touring. I keep very, very busy and I can keep a lot busier. Yeah. I mean, I'm not trying to brag, but I turned down, more jobs than I accept. I turned down a wonderful job in New Zealand at Christchurch. Because I did Auckland, New Zealand a year ago. Mm-hmm. And I turned it down. I turned down a lot of gigs. And even now, I don't want to take a job if it takes 2 airplanes. Mm-hmm. I told the agents, if it involves a flight and a connection, skip it. Because the airplanes are so awful right now that I'll probably miss the connection. Definitely. So I lost a job in Cabo San Lucas because the planes didn't get me there on time.
Yeah.
And my agent almost got beaten up by the people down there for that reason.
Yeah.
So at this point now, I tell my agents, it's got to be a nonstop or forget it. Yeah. Well, how about all the smaller cities? I guess I'm not going to do smaller cities, am I?
Yeah.
You know, so I'm trying to take a lot less work. So I can have more time to relax, hang out at my home in Hollywood, play with a pet tortoise, you know, date some fun girls that are friends of mine out there, you know. So I'm trying to ease up a little bit as it is.
Are there certain sort of, I guess, recurrent patterns that you're kind of perhaps tiring of right now in your sort of life? Or?
Just travel. Mm-hmm. I'm just sick of traveling. It's wearing on me, you know. My agents also know, I'll work for a fourth of the price to do it in L.A.,
Yeah.
I'll work for half price to take an hour-long plane ride. Yeah. You book me to San Francisco, where I'm at now, Las Vegas, maybe even go to Portland or Washington or Seattle or San Diego, even maybe Salt Lake City, Utah. Mm-hmm. If you keep me an hour or 2 hours away from L.A., I'll work for less. If I have to fly across the country, I'm now losing a day to go, a day to get back, I'm dead. I'm going to hit for hard prices. So I'm almost pricing myself out of the business. I'm asking for too much money so they won't hire me.
Well, Ron Jeremy, thank you so much. It was a pleasure chatting with you.
Thank you very much. Thanks for all your questions.